Welcome to the Excellence in Training Academy, where trainers come to grow at excellenceintrainingacademy.com. I'm very pleased to have back with us this week, John Black. Dr. John Black is the president of Argonne National, Inc., a consulting business specializing in understanding sense-making, decision-making, training, evaluations, continuous improvement, and related research. His doctoral research was in data visualization, complexity, systems thinking, which we're going to talk about today, and insight generation leading to the decisions. He's a nationally recognized expert witness in federal and state courts. John has over 23 years of experience to include command level within law enforcement, including patrol, investigations, corrections, and training. His specialty areas include mental health response and long-term strategies, crisis negotiations, intelligence teams, mobile response teams, and use of force reporting, policy, and accountability. He's a senior instructor for defensive tactics, firearms, CQB, small unit tactics, and force simulation. He's done advanced training and involvement with sensitive administrative reviews involving use of force and officer malfeasance. He's an expert witness in federal and state courts for police practices, police training, also involves shootings, corrections, use of force, and administrative review practices. He also has over 30 years of expertise with military special operations, including U.S. Army Special Forces, civil affairs, psychological operations, civil intelligence, and national level operations. He was a senior trainer, instructor, and mentor in subject areas ranging from small unit tactics, firearms, and special operations, combat diving, patrolling, critical thinking, leadership, intelligence analysis, and decision making. John has lived in both the operator and the intel worlds and continues to consult on varied projects. Throughout it all, he has seen it all come back to that moment of insight that precedes the decision. So, John, welcome back to the Excellence in Training Academy.
Thank you. Glad to be here and always enjoy these conversations.
Likewise. And now the last conversation we had, the last interview was about decision making. And this is, I think, a continuation of that general theme. But what I want to talk about specific today is systems thinking. This is something that we're starting to, certain people are talking more about. And so can you, I know this is one of your areas of expertise. Can you just kind of explain or articulate what systems thinking is or define it? Or is there a quote or something that would give us an understanding of what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a great question. So systems thinking has, you're absolutely correct. You're seeing it sort of throughout. Everybody's beginning to throw terms on. It's showing up in blogs. If you go into a societal approach for systems, there's some wonderful societies out there. There's the Society of Judgment and Decision Making, which does that. There's actually the SDS Society, which is completely focused on systems. And there's a multitude of professional organizations with a lot of heavy duty thinkers that talk about systems. I'm going to be more generalized about it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to refer to systems thinking and systems approach as interchangeable. Not a Forrester did stock and flow. There's a like I said, a ton of seminal researchers in this area. I'm just going to say that it's just sort of looking at the world and understanding that in a majority, if not all, of today's world, the problem you're focusing on is one that has interconnections. In other words, not only are there interconnections, it's not just A or B binary thinking. It's not just my view of the world. There are interconnections. All of these things got to this point by an interconnection of things, an interaction of things. And whatever decision you make ripples out into the next interconnection, interaction of things. It's continuous. It's acting, understanding that you're acting within the context of an environment that's interconnected. What that will do from a thinking approach is it helps you to step back from black, white, right, wrong, good, bad. It gets you more about understanding versus solution-centric. Now, I'm not arguing that you should not try to arrive at the solution. No, that's not what I'm saying. That's not what systems thinking says either. But what it does is it allows you to really focus on creating a very rich understanding in order, regardless of the decision. Now, again, I realize this is a long answer, but it's going to sort of frame it, is often systems deal with what's called complex systems. And that's what I'm talking about, how complex systems deal with complexity. Complexity has a lot of things about it. Well, one of the things about complex systems, or complex systems, CAS, is they have this property that's called emergence. And what that really means is that in the system, things will come out of it that it was literally impossible to foresee. The arrogance is that we think that by, if we break it down to its most minute detail, reductionism, that we can somehow understand it. And if we solve this one gear, in police jargon, if we just throw money here, take money away from here, if we put more people here, take money, if we just give them de-escalation training or don't give, whatever it is, the goal is sort of like root cause analysis. I'm just going to get to this one thing and that's going to fix it. Systems thinking or a systems approach would argue differently from that. That because of its interconnection and that it will ripple out into the next problem, this is wicked problem theory, we only know the ultimate effect by looking in hindsight. Well, if that's the case, then what would a systems thinking approach involve? Well, it'd be almost more like the Hippocratic Oath. When you're applying a solution, if it gets to that point, your first thing should be to do no harm, should not be to make the situation worse. And how would you do that? How would a systems thinker apply things? And there's best practices under the Kinevin framework, some of the work that's done by the Cabrera Research Learning Lab out of Cornell. There's a whole bunch of people that are doing good things in this. As cops, we don't just have to sort of like, crap, I don't know. You can actually, there's tons of work. I've spoken at the Society of Advanced Management, Society of Decision Professionals, and I've actually asked, I've requested, hey guys, you guys are really good thinkers in this stuff. Can you help and start looking at cops? Because most of these societies are siloed away from law enforcement.
Excellent. So as you talk about this, it seems to me that, you know, we have these complex problems. There's so many interconnections that are involved that we tend to just ignore or not look at. I know there's a quote that you use on your website, and that's from Mencken, that says, for every complex problem, there's a simple solution, and it's almost always wrong. Is that the problem, that we're looking at the outcome and we're immediately trying to jump to a simple solution, that the simple solution is defund the police, or the simple solution is that we're going to implement implicit bias training or de-escalation training or something else? We're coming up with the simple thing rather than taking a step back and look at all of the things that are part of this system that may have caused this issue for us?
Oh no, Brian, you're spot on. I think there's a lot, and the reason why I like that quote, and you've already highlighted it. The first thing that quote tells you is that solution is more important than understanding. That's how we have to get to a solution. Yeah, but the very nature of complexity and everything else is that you never fully solve these problems. We don't solve poverty. We don't solve crime. We're not going to solve what it is that we believe police should be doing. We were having a conversation before this podcast about the Peelian principles of 1829. There's been talk for almost two centuries about what it is police should do, and that's in a constant state of flux. Should we carry guns? Should we be protectors? Should we be the first person that's called for de-escalation? So the first thing is, that's a solution that quote highlights the fact that we look at the solution as a measure of success, that the solution or the outcome is by what we judge that. Now, that's not wrong. We have to take a look at outcomes and solutions, but it's only one side of the problem, because that also it doesn't focus on the needed understanding. Complexity and everything else that deals with that, and policing is complex. There's multiple competing goals. There's multiple drivers. There's places where, back to your stuff, what should we interconnect? Should the minority that is talking the loudest, that is heard, that has the most bandwidth on social media, should we be addressing that? Should we be addressing the majority of what it is? What about all the people that don't speak yet? And I'll use a police thing, all the people that don't speak, but yet routinely vote for police. Well, how do we determine what it is that it is that the interconnection we should be looking at? Well, the focus is just a shift in focus, is to focus on understanding, to focus on what else needs to be understood. What else could I understand? How is this affecting the problem? How could it be affecting the problem? And you live in the understanding space continuously. You're always focused on revising your understanding. So if you were always focused, if that became a goal, increased understanding is your goal, you would then create feedback loops and in terms of system methodology, sensors and feedbacks and methods that reach out to additional perspectives with the ultimate goal being a continuous, richer and refined understanding. Now, if you had that, and this is me speaking as the old inteller, one would argue that you would have at least better decisions. Next piece that stems from that quote. Every decision is just a entryway, and complexity at least, is just a entryway into the next problem. If we manage complexity, and the easiest one I can give this for the listeners is just think about medical conditions. I'm getting older. Everybody does. The same meds that worked for me earlier don't work for me in the same way. If you have people that have chronic diseases, diabetes, or anything else, you manage those over time to get the desired result of quality of life. Sometimes we do more, we do less, we have different things for it, but you don't solve it. Now, we might get a cure for diabetes down the road, and that'd be nice, but we don't solve it. We manage it. And the way to think about this is like an air traffic controller. You got 15 gauges in front of you, and you're trying to keep all those gauges within a certain range so that overall they give an acceptable value of whatever your goal is. In this case, things don't run into each other, right? In the case of a diabetic person, a quality of life, to do what it is that you want to do. So the other thing is, if we get to understanding centric compared to solution centric, and to your point, if we focus only on the outcome and the error, the downside of that is we go backwards and say, that's it. That's the guy that did it. That's, we just need to defund. We just need to do this. Okay, just maybe, but I can't with good conscience as a guy that studies this say that we even have a good understanding of what's going on. So then the question comes, well, how can we get a better understanding? Well, that is a really good question. That's a question that a good systems thinker would ask. And there's different frameworks and best practices that can actually help you with that.
So when we talk about better understanding, we talk about these simple solutions. I guess one of the things that jumps to mind, and you mentioned it, is something like de-escalation. So there's those that propose that de-escalation is the solution to the problem, and others are going to say, well, de-escalation is an outcome. And there's a whole bunch of interconnected things that are going to lead to that outcome. Is this part of it that we don't even define some of these things? Somebody labels de-escalation as some magical verbal tactic. And so we're going to jump on that and tick the box and say everybody's been trained in de-escalation, when we can't even agree on what exactly that is, whether it is a tactic or whether it's an outcome or what the elements of that are.
Oh, no. And de-escalation is a really good, I get it, it's controversial. So you'll probably get a bunch of comments coming in from listeners that have, we'll say, an emotional connection to it, but respectful of everybody, I'll offer my 2 cents for it. First of all, you're correct. In my mind, you're absolutely correct. Is it a verb? Is it a noun? In the words of Saturday Night Live, is it a dessert topping or floor wax? Yes, it's depending on who you talk to, it's freaking everything. So here's the thing. Me as a systems guy, when I look at de-escalation, and I've taught it, and I was a negotiator and that kind of stuff, the idea is, why is it that two things are happening? One, there is the belief that de-escalation is a cure, can be used everywhere, and if we apply against this, it's a magic bullet, it will stop this thing from happening. So the first belief is that it's a something, a tool, a this, a that, and we don't even know what that is. The next one is it could be just a concept to use lesser force than what would be justified under the law. That's a form of de-escalation. It's literally to not be there, to go down. There's another thing is like, well, that's all fine and good, but what about if we're not being resource funded? De-escalation usually assumes, depending on your practice, that we have control of the situation to a degree where we can de-escalate. de-escalate. Usually it's two people. Last time I checked, the person has to agree to be de-escalated to some point, and not formal agreement, but it's sort of like if you were to go to psychotherapy, one person there, has to agree that they will do the work, right? Whatever it may be. So there's all of these interconnections to this idea. But at the core of this, a very interesting way to look at these problems is, what is it that, if de-escalation is a solution, forgetting about the understanding of de-escalation, what is a solution? What's the problem that we're trying to solve? Arguably, the problem is what we're trying to do is, in cases where police apply use of force, whatever it may be, physical force or greater, and it results in a potential injury or some, quote, undesirable outcome to the person they're applying force, is there a way that we could either reduce this or eliminate it and bring it to zero? That's the actual problem that we're looking at. Now, some people say, oh, it's easy. We just de-escalate everything. For the reason I just mentioned, that's not going to happen. And you don't have time when, you know, we're in lethal force and someone's pointing a gun at you or something else is going on. So we already know that you can't bring it to zero. But if we were to focus on that problem, is there a way that we can reduce use of force or have techniques or have technology that would result in less injury to those it's applied against? Wouldn't police and everybody around the table be seeking the same thing? Because now we're talking about the context of the problem. Systems thinking is always applied in the context of totality, all the factors that are affecting it. Well, again, and this is a quote from Hegel. It's not a quote from Hegel. It's a concept attributed to Hegel, posiwid, which is POSWID. The purpose of a system is what it does. POSWID. So what's the purpose? What's the purpose? Now, let's just talk about the concept. And we'll apply a systems approach, a systems thing approach to police use of force. What's the purpose of police use of force? Well, it's multiples. It's safety. It's establishing control. It's, self-defense and other. According to Graham versus Connor, we can use it to effect an arrest, obviously a lawful arrest. We can prevent escape. There's different things under Whitley Alber and different case laws and different concepts for your policies. But what's the purpose? What are we trying to do with it? And once you know the purpose, you then modify the structure of the system. Now, if your purpose is apply it with never injuring the suspect, apply with never injuring a threat, apply without never injuring a person in mental crisis, and the outcome is just an evidence and it's an undesirable effect, the system isn't doing that. The system isn't working. Okay, well, then let's go back and figure out what we can do and how to look at it in a different perspective. Well, now I know why it isn't working, because you're doing this. It's not working because you're not de-escalating. That might be true. There might be times when we can do whatever this fuzzy concept of de-escalation is. It usually has a couple principles. We slow down a little bit. But the fact is, there's going to be a multitude of things that the other party, the other actor, suspect, victim, whatever you want to call them, doesn't agree to be de-escalated. The difference is the way you look at the problem.
So when we look at that concept of thinking differently and looking at these problems differently, I know something else that you and I have talked about before that I pulled off your website is this concept that we must adopt a systems approach, understand complexity, and shift to a continuous system improvement mindset rather than seeking simple solutions. and where to fix the blame. It seems to me that we're jumping all over that. We want simple solutions and we want to fix the blame rather than shifting to a continuous systems improvement mindset. What are some of the keys for us to shift that mindset, to think differently? Is it having certain people within the organization that it's their job to put forward those different thinking models, or how do we start to make this shift within our organizations?
Yeah, no, that's a really good, it's a really good question. So, I'm going to give a little sort of example, and that's going to highlight the concept. And then the question is, how do we apply that concept more holistically to an organization? Hey, you've just been involved in a use of force event. It's just, you know, it's going to hit the news. It is going to suck. It's bad. Chiefs all over you, everything's going on, and you apply your best investigative team over it, and you got the attorney's office screaming at you, you got everybody, welcome to policing in 2021 if you decide to shoot somebody or anything else. Now, should those investigations absolutely be occurring? Absolutely they should. They should. But here's my question. Why aren't we learning from the things that work? Where's your investigation with that same degree of everything that went right? One of the core things, and there's a lot of really good people I have conversations with. Scott Savage does excellent job on de-escalation. Dr. Winsky, and I work with him on a bunch of stuff. His crew's just amazing. You got Paul Taylor doing amazing work in these things. You got Jamie Borden with his crew out there. You got Dave Blake. I mean, I can just run on. We're having the good conversations. We are. So Vertra, Lombartel, Polis, Wender, I mean, there's Lambda, all these guys, yourself, Adam, Kanakin, Isla, we're trying to do this. So I'm not faulting that at all. I'm not. We're doing good stuff for good reasons. But here's the thing. A good process, a good system, the black box, can produce an undesirable outcome. And a box that could be improved upon, we'll call it a performing system, can still produce good outcomes just by the laws of chance, just by the fact that it happened. The outcome is not the measure of whether you have the best process or a good process or that. So instead, if we are focused on the system, this box of stuff in the middle, and our focus was learning, always, every event. And I'll take, NTOA is very good about this, SWAT's very good about it, we were very good about it in SF. Every training, every event, whether it went right or whether it went wrong, got the same critical after action review. Now, what's the difference? I told you I'd take a small case concept and bring it back. The difference is this is a learning organization, and you have made, and this is also, you can go to Cabrera's stuff. His argument with systems thinking is that your organization and organizational model is vision, mission, capacity, learning. Learning is the last cornerstone. You've made a conscious choice to be a learning organization. Every event, if the outcome was good, if the outcome was undesirable, doesn't matter. Every event is a learning event. Every day is a learning day. Every shift is a learning shift. You make it pervasive in the culture that the only way you could fail is if you didn't learn something. That's the shift. Now, what can you do about that? You focus on learning. So remember I told you about the Kinevin framework in the beginning. One of the things you do with complex systems is they use, this is a Kinevin framework, and they use what's called safe to fail probes. And safe to fail probes, they're usually real quick, they're really cheap, they have a limited duration and time, and you sort of define the problem loosely, and you say, okay, so what do we think's happening here? How can we know that? It's what I call a radioactive dye experiment. You're throwing radioactive dye in the organism, seeing how it behaves. Hey, we think this is happening over here. Well, let's try it out. As long as we're not going to kill anybody, and as long as that, and it doesn't cost a lot of money, And the only things about it is when you're developing it, you want experts in other fields. They give you different perspective. And you want what I call the naive realist or the Napoleonic corporal. Napoleon always made a corporal, and in those days, a corporal didn't have a lot of education, always made the corporal read his op orders. If the corporal could understand it, it was published. If the corporal couldn't understand it, it was rewritten. It's always good to have someone in the trenches, right? And so you have this idea, hey, let's try this. But the difference is you're not using it to solve something. You're using it to learn if your assumptions about the problem are correct, incorrect, or somewhere in between. It's radioactive dye. Let's see it. You're throwing it in. You can turn it off really quickly if you're wrong, like, crap, that was stupid. Or if it's working, which is a beneficial side effect, you can recreate it in another place and see if it works over there. Another precinct, another that. Well, again, that's a learning model. So to your point, continuous incremental improvement. That's the goal. I forget his name, amazing guy, sufferer of Down syndrome, and he's in the 1% society. And his entire model is every day he becomes 1% better. He's doing the Ironman. It's amazing what every day learning and becoming 1% better can do.
And that's I love that concept of 1% better. And I know that James Clear talks about that in Atomic Habits and about that commitment to that continuous incremental improvement. Is part of this, so I think what I see is some agencies in their literature call themselves learning organizations because they've made a bunch of people read the fifth discipline. And so they say now we're a learning organization. But there's no learning that occurs on a day-to-day basis, and we don't involve people at the operational level. So we don't have those frontline supervisors doing continuous learning and the officers, boots on the ground, taking that approach. Is that part of it that we need to weave this into the entire organization where everybody sees that it's their responsibility to be continually asking good questions and learning from these experiences?
Oh, I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. And I just looked them up. The guy's name in the foundation is the 1% Better Foundation, and it's Chris Nikic. Just an amazing dude. So yes, to your question, it is absolutely the case. But here's the thing, and you brought up a bunch of good stuff. If we're learning, we're asking questions. Wait a minute. If he's asking questions, he's challenging authority. That's not the way we do it here. Just do it. Ooh, that's going to really help an organization. Well, that means that every time we should ask questions. Nah, if you're asking questions all the time, you're not getting stuff done. So, John, tell me exactly what percent of the time we should be asking questions. You are not doing systems thinking. You want an easy answer, and you want me to tell you 80%, 83%. Well, how would we know the standards? If we get fuzzy about the standards, there's no way you can enforce it. Sure you can. You enforce fuzzy standards every single day. They're called values. Okay. So the difference is this is harder work. Learning is harder work. I read the fifth discipline. This is an attendance model. Did you read the fifth discipline? Sure, I read it. What did you learn? Wait, let me go look to the concluding paragraph of every statement and look at the cliff notes. That's what I learned. Really? Really? Did you learn that? Did we actually say how would we apply it to the organization? Did anybody say that this is bullshit? It doesn't have any meaning to us? Did we actually talk about it? Did we internalize it? Did we apply an abstract faction? How does this organization that we're talking about determine that learning has occurred? We're very good to determine that training has occurred, which loosely translates to attendance. And then after that, and actually Scott Savage brings this up a lot, and I applaud him for it, as do other people. But after that, we say, well, wait a minute, we know learning occurs. How do you know that? Because they took a test and they scored 80% on the test or greater, which was a minimum standard. So what you know is that they memorized enough stuff to pass a test because they're good test takers. What does learning mean? How do you become a learning organization? Learning is linked to innovation in business. How do you become someone that's innovative? Well, I would argue that the majority of organizations, and they may argue because they don't have enough time, and which is fine. It just means it's a place to start. Figure out how we can do this in less time. Figure out how we can do this. But again, at some point, the line's got to be drawn about, are we going to pursue being a learning organization? And if we are, then the only failure would be is if you don't continue to learn. We can learn from tragedy. We can also learn from success. We can learn every single day. Now, once you change that, and if you combine a learning organization with systems thinking, I think that would be amazingly powerful.
And I love that you talk about that we're in this attendance model, because that's my big, one of my big concerns and something I talk about is the question that we ask after you go to training is, instead of asking, what did you learn and how are you going to apply what you're learning and how are you going to share what you're learning? We ask, did you get a certificate? You did? Good. I need a copy of that certificate to put it in your file. And I mean, I've asked thousands of people that question about, you know, after you go to training, have you ever been asked, what did you learn? Have you ever had your supervisor make an appointment with you before you go to training for after the training to discuss what you learned? And almost nobody does that. You know, and we send people to get degrees, master's degrees. We send them to the National Academy and other lengthy programs. And nobody ever asks them, what did you learn? How are you applying what you're learning? And what are you doing to share what you're learning? So how do we combine this learning organization and systems thinking models? You mentioned that at the end. What are some of the things that we can do to start to weave these together?
Okay, so again, this is completely hypothetical. I get it. The first thing people are going to say is that there's no way it can be done. It's not feasible. Okay, that's fine. Everything wasn't feasible until it was. There's no way we'll ever get to the moon. Okay, just let's suspend judgment for a minute and we'll work backwards, because I can tell you that this has occurred in organizations, at least from my background in the military. And it started from a paradigm that said there's no way it could occur, right? I have a quote that I keep from Schopenhauer that's sitting behind me. All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. Third, it's accepted as being self-evident. So this is untrue. It's not, okay, this will never work. Oh, we've always done it that way. Okay, fine. I really don't care how we get there. So here's the thing, learning organization systems approach. First thing is we say we will work towards 1% every day becoming a learning organization, whatever it is. But we set that as a value or a goal. And then we start taking a look at things. And now let's go to what you just said, training, right? Now imagine this, imagine if you could create, for lack of a better term, a full-time FTO corps. Not just for recruits, for everybody. Oh, we got no money or anything else. That's fine. Doesn't really matter. I get that. But we find, that's incorrect either. Whether you do or you don't, there are very amazing ways you can do this. And that's another discussion. You can be creative in anything from technology to other things. But imagine if you had for a moment in the old model, FTOs, a full-time FTO corps. They attend the training, just like you said. They take their multiple choice test. All that shows is that they received the knowledge. It doesn't mean they can apply it. Okay. Now, after that training occurs, in service or otherwise, the FTO rides with the attendees of the class. Let's just say the class was in active listening, the class was in de-escalation, the class was in diversity, whatever it may be that you're teaching, the class was in first aid, okay? And they observe the person that attended to see if they are actually applying the principles and what they learned in real world calls. Well, but John, what happens if they don't show up? Well, if you need to measure that and it doesn't show up, somewhere within your thing, you basically reach on the guard channel, as I say, and you call your other trainer and say, hey, I need a guy that needs to come in and do CPR against a scenario. In the real shift, he books off and you tell him it's a training call. He arrives to it and say, do it. He's getting out of his real car in his real time with his real amount of sleep after having 16 cups of coffee with the same jitters and everything else that's going on because he's on shift differential and he thought he'd get a double in so he can go watch the game the next day. Whatever it is, that's real. And that's going to be a much better metric of learning. Can we do the same thing with policy at a command level? We absolutely can. It's actually easier. We can do sandbox problems and everything else, and we can bring in. So a lot of it we can do with scenario-based. We can create scenarios in the Zoom world. We're doing it now. We're doing it in role-playing and modeling. So that is a very simple example to show. Now, I get it. There's going to be argument that there's no way we can have a full-time FTO core. There's no that. But we still use FTOs for recruits. And now, where's your FTO for your sergeants when they get promoted? Where's your FTOs for your lieutenants when they get promoted? Wouldn't that be an example of a learning organization? And if it is, what would that program look like? What would you do? What about something as simple as bring your kid to work day? Remember when you did that and the kid would come to work to see what it is? Why not have bring your subordinate to work day? Show the normal patrol officer what it's like to be a sergeant. And then go in reverse. Subordinate, bring your supervisor to work day. Put the sergeant back in the car, put the lieutenant back in the car, put the chief back in the car to see what it's like to be back there. And you have rules. On those days, the chief holds the rank of the recruit while he's in the car and that kind of stuff, and he doesn't get to overrule him or anything else, unless obvious officer safety issues or stupidity. And then the first time, everybody would be on pins and needles. There's no way you'd basically just fail gloriously in front of your supervisor. I get that. But eventually, over time, you got to start somewhere. You will create a culture where you're focused on learning. It isn't going to happen overnight. It took us a while to get to where we are. It's going to take us a while to dig us out. We may never get there. That doesn't mean it's not worth fighting for.
So is part of this then embracing the power of question, that our natural tendency? So you talked about the FTO program and you said, well, what if we had a full-time FTO cadre? And people's immediate response is, well, we could never do that. Budget, whatever, personnel yeah. issues. Do we need to ask different questions? So you talked about, so if we could, what would that look like? What would be some of the elements? What would be some of the things that we do? And then when we start to follow up with more questions, does that start to flesh out some of the possibilities that we shut down right away? So we say, well, you know what, the chief will never go for that. Well, what if they did? What would that look like? How would we play this out? Is this the key that we tend to ask a lot of questions when we're doing an investigation, but we don't ask a lot of questions within the organization, is something that I see.
Well, I'm done here. I'm just going to have you teach this. You're spot on. I mean, just go execute what you just did, man. This is perfect. Yeah, absolutely true. I mean, just, you know, and then we can, and we just continue to ask questions. We don't get defensive about our questions. This is, there's different methodologies of facilitation. IBIS is one of them that's used for wicked problems, a couple other ones. But the difference is the focus on the question. And I was looking up while we were talking there. Basically, there's a whole ton of books out on this. I know that. But there's the right. So RQI, which is the Right Question Institute, it gives actual methodology to help with what you just described. It takes a couple of weeks, but there's a couple of responses. I think the little certificate to just get introduced to it is like $90. It's not that expensive, obviously. And then so the question then is about questions is we use questions. We don't become defensive about questions. we're all on the same goal. We ask a question in order to gain better understanding. So we look around the room and say, our goal here is to gain better understanding. We're not going to argue for or against some of the solutions. We're not going to do any of this kind of stuff. We're just going to try to figure this out. And by figuring out, it means we're not going to come to a solution. Our goal, at least for this time we're sitting down, is to come to the best and richest understanding. And so the book by Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, A More Beautiful Question, really highlights that. The focus is on the questioning part. So first thing is what you just did. Ask all those questions about, hey, you know, what would it look like? Ask questions about the art of the possible. How about, have other organizations done this? Have other disciplines done this? Do you really think that in the very beginning, aviation and everything else that are known, that in medicine that are known, engineering is another field, that are known for looking internally at their own people and examining themselves critically, do you really think they didn't start off as a blame organization? Not to say that they aren't still to some degree today, but the fact is that they do amazing work in systems theory, error stuff by Decker, Reason, and Conklin, all this kind of stuff. How about asking questions about the negative, internalized metacognition questions? Why do we think this? What about our history is causing us to have these assumptions? Why do we believe, fill in the blank, the negative? Why do we believe it's not feasible? Because there's not enough money. Okay, let's take that. Have we done other things that we thought were unfeasible when there hasn't been enough money? And I'll bet money, no pun intended, that some range instructors will tell you, I found ways to train like moving targets by pulling string and doing plates and cutting little holes into that. Oh, fine. Now we're going to say, yeah, but this isn't the range. Okay, I get it. But that's not what we're focused on. We're changing the frame of one's perspective to get you from, there's no way this could happen, to, you know, I might not be able to see it right now, but maybe there is a creative way that could happen. Now we're shifting from proving the negative, I will keep showing you why it can't happen, to entertaining the possible. Will it come out any different? I can't guarantee that. I'm sorry, Brian Unica. I can't guarantee that, but I can tell you it's still a good thought exercise. Anyway, go ahead, sir.
No, and I love the way that you frame that. And it seems to me that there's a couple elements there that are key. Is number one is that we set the framework to start with, that we're not here to come to solutions. We're here to come to a better understanding, because we tend to be very, I think, very solution oriented. And that gets us into trouble when we go home and our spouse just wants to talk and we want to solve all the problems. But it seems to me that the other piece is something that we're talking more about. And I'm concerned that it's going to become a buzzword. And that's a psychological safety that Amy Edmondson talks about, where it's safe in the organization for you to raise your hand and ask a question, or to say, I think there is a better way, or is there a better way, or have we considered this, or what about this? Are those a couple of the key elements that we can frame it, first of all, that we're looking to come to a better understanding, and then, but we need to create that culture where it's safe to ask a question? So Napoleon, somebody brought that up as a leadership workshop I was doing a little while ago. And it seemed to me that in a lot of organizations, if that corporal would have disagreed with Napoleon or the equivalent of Napoleon in that organization, he would be immediately fired or dismissed. They would tell the boss what they think the boss wants to hear, as opposed to what the boss needs to hear. So are those a couple elements to frame it, that we're looking to come to a better understanding and to create a culture of psychological safety where we encourage people to ask questions and it's safe to ask questions and to challenge?
Yeah, it is. And so let's bring this back to systems theory. One of the things of systems theory is we're going to constantly reach out and say, do we have the needed perspectives to understand this problem in a rich and meaningful way? Do we have the needed perspectives? Well, that's always going to involve questions. And depending on the way you ask questions and if you get defensive about everything else. But again, if the culture begins to focus that they're there to improve, they're there to learn, learning starts from asking a question. Why did that happen? What can we do this? Now, it is a, there's an old maxim in the military, never confuse easy with simple. And I guess the other maxim is the simple way is always mind. But the idea of never confusing easy with simple, it's very simple. E equals MC squared is very simple, elegant in its simplicity. Doesn't mean it's easy. Asking questions. One of the ones that you just had. I think there is a better way. Is that a question? Or is that a way of getting your solution in? So what you have to do is it's hard. It's really hard because we have been taught since the FTO sat on our right seat driving to a call. What are you doing? Where are you looking? What's happening? If the guy comes out the door, I want you to decide what we've got with only three of the needed pieces of 100 pieces of information that could affect it. And you still acted. You had to. You responded. What are you going to do? And you responded in the absence of information, and you were judged on your action. If you did not act, you were failed. In the old days, that would be below 4, right? We go up to sergeant. The lieutenant walks in the room. What do you got? What are you going to do about it? Those questions have about a 3-second time lag, if you're lucky. Very few lieutenants will say, what did you got? How did you come to that determination? What else could it be? What else might we be missing? Based on what you got, what are you thinking? If these other things that you're missing came in, what else might you be thinking? Oh, now that's a completely different discussion, isn't it? But that's not what we're trained. So we take that same training, that same, and we're rewarded. Think about it. Who gets promoted? Yeah, I really don't want to promote John. He thinks about shit too much and never comes to a solution. In fact, we view spending time in the understanding space as, yeah, he can't make a decision. We actually use that for promotional criteria, that time is the statement he can't make a decision. And in fact, you go over to Bob. No, we got to promote Bob, man. He is decisive. He's leadership material. He can make a decision in crisis. How many times have Bob's decisions been right? How many of them resulted in a good outcome? How many times just by luck of the draw went right? Not to use words like right and wrong, but we'll call it, I'm using right to be a desirable outcome or an allowable outcome. How many times did Bob learn from his decisions, regardless of whether they had a desirable outcome or an undesirable outcome? Now, those would be good questions for leadership material. But we don't do that. Our culture isn't really geared towards that. So one of your earlier points you raised, inducing this culture should start from literally the day of recruitment. And this is just my 2 cents world of thought. When we review the candidate that's been accepted, how many times do we do a post-recruit interview and ask them and tell them, these are our values. Oh, we quiz them on our values. If they can't list out, you were talking about 7 values versus 6. If they can't list out the 6, you only listed 5 of the 7. Let's see, in math, I'm giving you 7 points. You only get 5 out of 7 for that question. Okay, so you can memorize stuff, right? Now you begin to, you talk to the recruit on the stuff and you tell them, you remember that value, we're a learning organization. So I want you to tell me as the first thing we came in, what did you learn from this? How are you learning? How did you do that? Where did you learn that from? I'm going to have an interview with him to begin to figure out how he or she learns. What should I as an organization, what should we learn from this? Wow, I guess they really are about learning. Now you go into the training and recruit academy. Everybody has a journal at the end of the day. What did you learn? What did you think we were trying to teach, but you were unable to learn? And when the guy says, I was unable to learn, the person comes to them, they don't yell at them. They don't tell them you're an idiot. They don't tell them anything else like this. And you say, okay, how can I help you to learn? This isn't a failure. This is a place that is now a clue about where more learning needs to take place. That's all it is. And we keep doing that. Now, let's take this all the way out. Imagine this was happening at every level. Systems approach. Now what happens is you go to the citizen board. What do you think it is we should be learning? Now, isn't that an interesting question? Well, I would really like to have you guys learn a way to end these use of force encounters without anybody getting hurt. Okay, let's talk about that. Is there such a thing that will happen? Yeah, de-escalation. Well, let's have this since we're having a mutual conversation. I would really like you to learn what de-escalation means, not to be facetious and going backwards. But the idea is, so I think the first thing we have to agree as a group here is we should learn about what's out there, what it really entails, and let's get there and just, we're all going to focus on what does a taser do? What does a baton do? Let's all operate from the same definition of terms. In any research paper that you put in for peer review, you have the abstract. It's not really part of the paper. It's the abstract, but you have introduction. And if there's any terms that need to be defined, they're defined right then and there after the introduction. Because why would you have the rest of the conversation, a paper, without having everybody using the same language or dialect? But we don't do that. But that's a hallmark of learning. It's found in academia. Again, we could go on and on, and I apologize to your listeners for rambling and pontificating, but you've hit on an area, obviously, I'm very passionate about. So.
No, and I think it's such a great area because, you know, I think we need to learn to ask better questions. David Marquet, who's a retired nuclear sub commander, talks about switching when he took over the command of the USS Santa Fe, which was the worst ranked sub in the entire fleet. It was the joke of the nuclear submarine fleet. And 12 months later, they got the highest rating that any ship in the US Navy had ever received. But he made a shift from what he calls briefings to certifications. Because he said, for example, loading torpedoes. Everybody would show up, the NCO or the senior NCO or the officer in charge of that would go to the loading torpedoes part in the manual, read it all off, and then say, everybody good with that? Everybody got any questions? So those fake questions that we ask, and nobody's going to put their hand up. So what they shifted to was a series of questions. The certification was, so what's your job? What are you thinking about? What decisions might you have to make? What are you worried about? What could go wrong? And then those questions prompted other questions. And then they got good information and started to develop an understanding of, do we know what it is needed here? Is that part of it, that we need to learn to ask better questions and keep working at this? So when we ask a fake question, we make a statement in the kind of the form of a question that somebody says, well, how would you reframe that into a better question? Is that part of the learning here?
I think it's a big part of it. And in his work or what he recounted, the idea of certification was he was asking questions in such a way to confirm that two things had occurred. And they're sort of like an overlapping Venn diagram. Learning and the capability to apply what was learned in an abstract or practical situation. That was the difference between memorization and just agreement to, well, then tell me, show me if in a contingency, show me that. I could see him even saying, okay, so show me what valve you would turn. Show me where you'd be standing when that would happen. What happens if we list 30 degrees to the right? What it does is starts me as a student then, the person being asked the question, it starts me thinking, well, crap, I never thought about that. What would I do? And what I'm doing now is taking it one step further, is I'm building schema. Back to recognition prime decision modeling, the use of expert schema, some of the stuff that Force Science is working with, everything else. I'm beginning to build my schema. I haven't tested my schema. I haven't validated against expert schema. But I'm beginning to span my schema, my blueprint of the world. If this happens, this. And then I train my schema. Now, back to de-escalation. Well, what would you do in this? If you had a mental here or this here or that here, but now, okay. So now you're going to start talking to them. Now, is that scenario? It doesn't have to be. It's mental modeling. The recognition prime decision modeling and a short version of this is recognition. What have I got? Go through the Rolodex. It's this. In OODA, it would be observe and orient, my orientation. In higher level, it would be attend and perceive. What my interpretation, right? Okay. Now, using satisficing for decision making, the idea of the first available solution that will work. Not that will work perfectly, not the best solution. The first available solution. That's what we do in time compressed type of situation making. There's a lot of work done by Simon that did it, Herbert Simon, and also Carl Weick that did it in application. But that's what we do. We select the first thing that's going to work based on our recognition, right? And then we very quickly, some people use the word model it, other people use, I use basically the concept of stress test it in nanoseconds in our mind. Okay, I've got this occurring. Okay, the last time I did something like this, or Bob did something like this, or this worked, solution, playbooks 72B. I pull out 72B, I run it through real quick. Let's see, I got a rope. I got a car. We're 15 feet away. Oh, crap. We're too close. It won't work. Okay. What happens if I go further away? Okay, now it'll work. All I'm doing is quickly modeling it and saying, and if I get to the point where it says works, go, we're done. If I get to the point at the bottom, it says no way it will work. I run up real quick and say either next solution or I got the problem wrong. Reorient. Figure out what it is. This is it. And I get it. This is not... I can lay out the so-called formal technical terms, but this is it in a nutshell of what we do. Well, that's what we need to start doing. We need to start focusing on questions that help us build that stuff and build that schema. And to your point, the better question in my mind is ones that help us get to that. The better question is one that gives us knowledge that we didn't have before we asked it. Versus the question that is trying to just elicit a way to confirm what I think is already true. You know, we should be asking questions about things that if they were known would really make a difference.
So what would be your advice to trainers or leaders who say, you know what, I love that philosophy. Where do I start? So if that's a question they have, where do I start? How do I start to build this into the organization so that we can weave it into the culture so that ultimately we're embracing the systems thinking and striving to become a learning organization? What are some of the keys to starting with this from an implementation standpoint?
Really good questions. The first place I would probably start is, let me think this through. If it was me, I tend to start reading about stuff just to get myself a little more comfortable with the terminology. I pick things that sort of stretch my prior beliefs. I pick things that will help me get a little bit further down the road and help me understand it better. Places to start for just quick reading on that. We've mentioned some of these before too. Thinking in Systems by Donella Meadows. It's a primer. It's just real easy reading. Very interesting book to help you understand systems was a book that just came out by Daniel Kahneman, Nobel laureate, and his crew. And it's basically a second book to Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, and it's called Noise. And it highlights that all systems have an inherent level of error and found within their structure. we'll never reduce error to zero, regardless of whether we remove biases or anything else. So what that will do is they will give you a good look. A beautiful question by Berger, Warren Berger, helps you think about questions differently. I think that's a good place. If you want to know more about systems thinking, Albert Rutherford writes a whole series on the systems thinker, dynamic systems, mental models, the systems thinker in general. And his books are an easy read, and they sort of get you in the right mindset. So that would be the theoretical place. The next thing is, for concrete practice, start doing. And the easiest way to do this, and if you want to, go on to the Cornell Learning Lab. He has a little blurb, a bunch of stuff, all free. You just click on it and watch some of the videos out of there about thinking and systems. One in particular, once you watch it, it tells you, now go out and practice. Go take a look at what you're looking at right now and saying, how would I look at this if this was a system? What perspectives are involved? What this? Use your questioning learning to make yourself a better learner about systems. And just start doing it yourself. Don't try to change the world. Change yourself first, right? From Lao Tzu, from a good person comes a good family. From a good family comes a good village. From a good village comes a good nation, et cetera, et cetera. After you do that, get some companions, because fighting old thinking is draining and brutal sometimes. And you need some people like this is why I enjoy this so much. You need some people that you can take, like Brian. And he's like, John, I know. And I'm like, okay, I just want to make sure there's still hope. There's other people out there that are beginning to at least think somewhat like that. Okay, back to the trenches. So get some other people, and there will be other people in your organization that are willing to entertain this. Now, after you get that, then begin to think in the 1%. If you understand learning, if you understand systems, if you understand the beauty of learning starting from a question, you can begin to frame that into small little, we'll call them Kinevin experiments or safe to fail probes. And an easiest way to get these things through is you say, hey, boss, I want to do a little pilot study. It's going to be 6 months. And all we're going to do on that is, you remember I'm doing about learning, is I want to learn more about this. I'm not going to tell you it's going to solve it or not. I can tell you if it does work, I got no problems with running it after 6 months. But people don't get too pissed off about doing a study, a pilot, a seeking of additional information. When you say we're going to institute this, oh my God, everybody throws their arms up about why, because it's easy to say no. One of the things I used to have for my leadership principles of any of my supervisors, I said, here's the deal. Your job is to say yes for anything that anybody brings to you. You have to prove to me why you said no by exception. That's it. They know what's going on. If you looked at it and they know what's going on, you don't have to, I don't care. Your job is to find a way to say yes. If there's a no, you have to explain it to them, and then you have to explain it to me. And that was one of the principles I put out to my guys.
I love that.
That's how you support your troops.
Absolutely. I love that philosophy. Now, the trainers that are listening, it seems to me as you talk about that they're in an ideal position to do this learning, but then to start to model this, to start to build the questioning into their training, where they're asking more and telling less and modeling that for people and in their incident command training, their leadership training, in all of their training, so that the people start to see the value in the questioning. Is that one of the great advantages that trainers have, that they're in a tremendous position of influence to start to model this and implement this into their training to get people to start to think differently?
I would argue that not only are they in a great position, I would argue they are in the most influential position. A quick anecdote and story is a buddy of mine who did a lot of similar things and more so in the military was telling a story about General Sokolic. And General Sokolic used to be the Delta Regimental Commander. And he also afterwards commanded the United States Army John F. Kennedy Warfare Center schools the SWIC, basically the place where all SF go to learn specialized skills. It falls under SWIC, Warfare Center of Schools. And he commanded that. As I said, he was also Delta commander. They would run annual training meetings where all the other generals would come up and talk about what are we going to do and how are we going to do that. During one of these meetings, paraphrasing it, he said, basically by show of hands, but the idea is, I want all of the commanders here to tell me, show of hands, how many of you interact with every troop in your command, every operator, 2 times a year? None of them could. And he simply said afterwards, I do. What is the one universal, the one communicator that will occur throughout a learning organization that communicates values and what you stand for? It's the training core. There's the second paragraph of the NCO creed, the non-commissioned officer creed, is competence is my watchword. My 2 basic responsibilities will always be uppermost in my mind: accomplishment of the mission and the welfare of my soldiers. I will strive to remain technically and tactically proficient. I'm aware of my role as an NCO. I will fulfill my responsibilities inherent in that role, et cetera, et cetera. The NCOs were the trainer and still are the trainer of the military. They are the organizational and specialty continuation. All trainers are. They are the continuity of an organization. Leadership will shift. Other things will shift. The training communicates the continuity and the values of an organization. If your training is not part of its focus, communicating the values by modeling the example, you are missing out, and I would argue your training is inadequate.
And that's such a great point. And I think we miss the opportunity to, in our profession, to get those NCOs, those frontline supervisors, to understand their role as trainers in the organization, because they have that constant touch point with their people every single shift. And we just need to help them to understand how to do that effectively. So as always, John, a ton of great information. I mean, you and I had an hour-long conversation before we started the recording, and I always learn so much from the conversations that we have, and I'm so appreciative of your time. If people want to learn more about the work that you do or follow up with you, what's the best way for people to connect with you or follow you or follow up with you?
Oh, I'm not available always simply because of time constraints, but I will always pick up the phone for anybody fighting the good fight in any of your crew. So just type in Aragon National Inc. My website will show up. All my contact information is there. I'm on LinkedIn. All my stuff is there. It's just John Black. Just type in John Black. You'll see it. It will say Aragon and other stuff next to it. Between the website and that, my phone numbers, my addresses, that easiest thing to do is call. I'm old school. I get a lot more stuff from intonation and all of the nonverbals that can be communicated through an audio stream. I would argue, other than a Zoom call, which is a flat two-dimensional, still better than audio to some degree, but the problem, at least for initial contact, and if your initial contact, you want to say, hey, I want to talk to you, but these are the times, then just send an email for that and then we'll talk. But the idea of something complex in a worded statement, the only thing I can guarantee is whatever you intended is not going to be what I receive, AKA the communicator model. And my response will probably be just as bad for you. So instead, let's cut out the middleman, send the time. But any of your folks, again, I do this because it needs to be done. So if you guys are doing the same thing, I will help however I can.
And I appreciate that. And you certainly are true to your word with that. And I appreciate all of your time and your energy. And so, John, I want to thank you for making the time today. More importantly, I want to thank you for everything that you have done. You're over 23 years in law enforcement, you're over 30 years of military service, but all the work you continue to do to continue to do the research and your expert witness work and continue to do these interviews to help us think differently and expand our way of thinking. So for everything that you have done, everything you continue to do, thank you so much for your contributions and your commitment and for your service.
The pleasure and honor is mine.
And so to the members of the Excellence in Training Academy community, as always, I encourage you to let the information that John shared, and he shared a lot of great information again today, simmer, percolate overnight, and then be intentional. Sit down tomorrow and take time to write out what I learned from that interview with John Black, and then write out your action steps, and then follow up on that and look to share that information and have conversations and to find ways to ask better questions. And so to the members of the Excellence in Training Academy community, as always, thank you for your commitment to excellence, both in and through training. Always continue to train hard, train smart, train with passion and purpose, and always be willing to dare to be great.